Welcome to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Paul Flav, in for David Martin Davies. A little later, we're going to be talking about the impact of last night's ruling by a Texas judge on the White House's guidelines for transgender students. But first, another big federal decision made waves just last week: for-profit detention. For decades, the industry has been holding on to federal, state, and local prisoners. The argument for them has always been that when run like a business, prisoners can be safer, more efficient, and of course, profitable. Last week, the Justice Department said the facts on the ground went the other direction. Here's Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates talking with NPR.
The fact of the matter is that private prisons just don't compare favorably to the Bureau of Prisons in terms of safety or security or the services that they offer to the inmates there. The Bureau of Prisons does a better job. And now, with our decline in the federal prison population, we have both the opportunity and, I think, importantly, the responsibility to do something about it.
For-profit prisons have seen increasing criticism on both the left and the right, but the announcement did come as a surprise for, if no one else, Wall Street, which saw the value of private prison companies like GEO and CCA lose half their value in a day. Is it time to close private prisons? Give us a call with your thoughts, 210-614-8980, or email us at thesource@tpr.org. Joining us to talk about this topic are Daniel Mears, a professor of criminology at Florida State University. Welcome, Daniel.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Gerald Gaze, criminal justice consultant who retired from the Federal Bureau of Prisons after 22 years. He at one point was director of the Office of Research. Gerald, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Daniel Mears, the federal government says it's going to shrink the population of its federal inmates under private prison control, seeking to eventually eliminate them. How big a deal is this?
I guess it's a really big deal. The privatization was a big something that was pushed prominently, especially in the 80s and 90s. It's arguably a key part of some of the prison expansion that occurred in the 80s and 90s up to the present, and it was something that liberals and conservatives were behind in part. So to do this very dramatic about face, at least for the federal government, is a pretty significant shift.
So when you say that both liberals and conservatives were behind this plan, give us the context for this big push. Why were they both on board for something that is very politically charged these days?
It is politically charged, but you know, criminal justice is one of those topics where you know sometimes it creates a common ground, and especially in the late 80s into the 90s, was concern that we needed to somehow toughen our response to crime. There were dramatic increases in prison populations in many states, and of course, Texas was one of the states where there was really dramatic growth, and there was a need to be able to accommodate that. And you know, you could build state prisons, but another way to accommodate the demand was to contract out for prison space, and that's something that I don't think initially was as, it wasn't as quite a prominent argument as today that somehow it was going to be a cost efficient. For example, it's a cost savings if you know. From a liberal perspective, if you build a prison, you're kind of stuck with it. But if you contract out for it, you always have the option of backing out of it when you don't need it. So from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense. But you could also argue, and the conservatives would be more likely to argue this, I think, that somehow they are more cost efficient. So you have both groups behind this in a context where there was dramatic prison expansion and there was funding for it as well. And so people weren't as concerned, I think, at the time as they are now about the need to really revisit what we're doing with incarceration.
Hey, Gerald Gaze, you were at the Bureau of Prisons when they started floating the idea of privatization in the federal system. Tell us about what the rationale you were hearing at the time.
At the time, it was primarily to save money, although, as Dan says, there was the impetus to try to bring on more capacity quickly. At the time, the Bureau of Prisons was expanding dramatically and continues to expand dramatically until about 2009. So there was that issue as well. But as a matter of fact, the initial privatized facility in the Bureau of Prisons was one that was built by the Federal Bureau of Prisons as a public facility. But then the Wackenhut, which became GEO, then in a kind of an experiment began to operate that prison initially, and that kind of started the privatization effort in the Bureau of Prisons.
So you were actually tasked with doing research on this topic way back when. What was it that you and your team were researching, and what did you find?
We looked at both the cost and the quality issue. And as a matter of fact, we had two competing studies at the time. The Bureau did not want to be seen as an entity which was, you know, kind of being self-promoting. So we also hired an outside contractor, Doug McDonald at Aft Associates. And so both studies found somewhat similar results, but the Bureau study did not find a great deal of cost savings, which was contrary to the Aft study's findings, and we think the Aft study made some mistakes. And we found that there were quality issues in the private facility.
So talk about why the push forward then, if there were these contrary studies. Were you just too, standing in front of a big wave, and that was really all you could do
was
to go forward?
It was partly that, and it was partly because there was this necessity to bring on capacity quickly. It takes quite a long time to bring on capacity in the Bureau of Prisons. There's a lot of studies that have to be done. There are environmental protection issues that have to be decided, and some of those can be circumvented by the private sector. So it's easier for them to bring capacity online faster. So it was partly facing the wave. At the time, I think the zeitgeist was that, you know, the privates could do it cheaper and better, and this was more a theoretical argument than it was an empirical assessment.
Well, I'm interested in this idea of private prisons as what it sounds like is almost a safety valve. You're trying to, you know, make ease the glut of overcapacity or over demand for space. We just saw this recently when for-profit companies were brought in line down in Dilley and Carnes here in Texas for immigrant detention, and actually there was a pretty big story from the Washington Post, Chico Harlan, we talked about it last week on The Source, exposing that $1 billion deal to keep these folks in these immigrant and refugee detention centers, and it was actually at a cost that was something around the case of more than the Ritz-Carlton per person, because they were getting paid whether or not there were people in these facilities. When you're talking about bringing on capacity quick, you're also talking about rushing contracts and rushing oversight. What did we see in terms of oversight for these kinds of facilities? Was there enough? Were people getting the kinds of notes on their performance that they should? Either of you.
I mean, I do think you have to do due diligence, like you say. You can't just bring on capacity willy-nilly without the planning. And as you say, oversight is probably the key. At one point, early on in the privatization process at the Bureau of Prisons, the private sector was complaining the Bureau had too much oversight, that they had too many people walking around the facilities and doing inspections, which was kind of a weird argument to make. So I can't speak to what happened after 2002 when I left. I don't know if the oversight became more lax. But it's kind of an ironic twist that the privates want as much freedom as they can to innovate, and so they want as much flexibility in their contract as they possibly can. And yet when they get caught violating certain policy and procedure, then they claim there's a little bit too much oversight.
And we're going to talk about that when we come back from this break. We're talking with Dan Mears from Florida State and Jerry Gase, formerly of the Bureau of Prisons. Private prisons, not the bargain they were pitched as. When we come back, we'll touch on why, as well as what it means for South Texas, immigrant, refugee, temporary detention. Are they impacted? Do you think it's time to end private prisons? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Profiting off the imprisonment of Americans, it doesn't sit right with a lot of people, but the cost and the exploding prison population were making people think twice 20 years ago. Now with a dwindling prison population, the feds are saying, we don't want any more federal inmates in these for-profit detention centers. We continue our conversation with Dan Mears and Jerry Gase. What are your thoughts? Give us a call, 210-614-8980, 614-8980. Dan Mears, professor of criminology at Florida State. Last week, the week before last, though, Office of the Inspector General came out with a report that was somewhat scathing about for-profit facilities. What were the big takeaways from that report?
Well, I think what you had the Deputy Attorney General saying at the beginning, they came out outright and, you know, largely said essentially they aren't being run as effectively, as cost efficiently, and, you know, so they we shouldn't use them. It's an interesting report because I don't want to defend or attack private prisons or the Bureau of Prisons, but the kind of study that the OIG did, the Office of Inspector General, isn't one that really, at least from where I stand, it would enable them to really draw that strong a conclusion. But that was a conclusion they worked from in determining apparently to shut down the contract.
What were some of the shortcomings shortfalls you saw on this report?
Well, one of the tricky issues with any kind of policy evaluation is you want to do apples to apples comparisons. You really want to make sure that you're comparing, say, one kind of prison facility, a private prison facility, to one that's a publicly run that's as nearly identical as you can in all respects. And that's not the kind of analysis that they did here. It's very difficult to do in the first place, but they didn't do that. And so you're left more with, we hope it's apples to apples. And if it is, then, boy, this looks bad for private facilities. And it might be that with a more rigorous type of analysis, they'd find the same thing, but it might be that they wouldn't.
Let's take a phone call. We're at 210-614-8980. This is The Source. We're talking about privatization of prisons. Abraham is on the line. Abraham, what's your question or comment?
Hi, yes. My comment is just around prison systems that are for a profit. I feel that whenever a system like this becomes a business, I don't think they look for the type of people they're putting into prison. It becomes a numbers game where they're wanting to put people in prison so that people could make their money and investors get their payouts, and you know, all that comes into play. So my only comment is that I would be against it, and I would think more people would be against that because more people are going into prison just for people to make profits. And if y'all could talk around a little bit about that.
Thanks, Abraham. Abraham brings up a good point. There's a profit incentive. Fortunately, the profit incentive does not extend to law enforcement in this instance, since they are a third-party contractor. Dan, can you touch on maybe what Abraham was saying and what his comment was about?
Absolutely. It is something that really, for a lot of people, seems wrong. The idea that that any company could profit from justice, and you know, people are going to agree. I think disagree about that. I think one of the nitty-gritty issues which makes this difficult is, you know, you imagine, just bring this down to the state level, imagine that they see a need to build a prison, that they might need more prison capacity, but for 1 year. And it would be almost unethical to build the capacity, because if you do, it's not good stewardship of scarce taxpayer resources. And you know that there's a risk that if you build it, then you're going to use it. And then you're going to come up with a justification. You lower the bar for who should go to prison. So that's clearly problematic. And a private facility, a temporary contract, could be a way of avoiding that. But you don't avoid the problem at all if that private contract essentially comes to be viewed as normal practice, and especially if there's lobbying that comes into play that results in retention of that temporary capacity, not just for 1 year, but 5 years or 10 years. And then you get into that land that Abraham talked about, which is you're talking about doing, you know, creating a profit incentive for it. And then you start to lose, I think, some of the defense for private facilities.
Gerald Gaze, former director of research for the Bureau of Prisons, also touching on this idea of how it doesn't sit right with a lot of people. There's a profit incentive. When we talk about how prisons are, if they can't extend their lobbying efforts successfully, there's also the idea of cutting services to prisoners. Can you talk about what, if any, research you've done on private prisons and how they serve their clients, which in this case are inmates?
Well, I mean, because they must demonstrate a profit, they have to, within the contract requirements, whatever their per diem is allocated, they have to squeeze profit from that per diem. So if these are corporate entities like CCA and GEO, even if they're private entities like NTC, their rationale is to squeeze as much profit. And one thing that usually is not addressed in this context is this is not really a liberal market. the consumer in this market is really the inmate, but the inmate can't walk away and go to another prison of his or her choice. So there really isn't a compelling way for the market to respond to lack of services that the private provider might find. And what happens instead is you'll get inmate riots because it's their only way of grieving at some point.
Yeah, and in terms of that kind of consumer choice, what you're talking about being actually a market for this, it would fall on lawmakers, and lawmakers would have to have information. And anyone that's ever dealt with, speaking from personal experience, trying to get information out of either the contractors for these prisons or the prisons themselves, the companies that own them, even the federal government, you're looking at a FOIA request that, you know, these days is 6 to 8 months away from being fulfilled. So it is very difficult to get this kind of information you're talking about. But I am interested, can you talk about the role of turnover at these facilities, either of you? When we see these kinds of prisons depicted on television, it's usually, you know, the quality of the staff does fall beneath your general Bureau of a Prison officer. Gerald, can you speak to that?
Sure. I think the single biggest problem that the private facilities have is the lack of high-quality line staff and the fact that there's a higher rate of turnover. A colleague of mine and I have done a study on turnover and found that the turnover is greater at private facilities. And a correctional officer's job is not an easy job. It's not just searching for contraband. It's dealing on a day-to-day basis with people who are in a situation where they don't really want to be. And so it takes quite a bit of experience in both the line staff and the middle management to be able to run a prison successfully. And I think that's the biggest problem that the private facilities have, is that they have a higher rate of turnover and they have a lower rate of pay. And and it's essentially, as the Deputy Attorney General said, you get what you pay for.
Dan Mears over at Florida State, I'm interested in who does this actually impact, this ruling, this decision from the DOJ? Who is included, who is not included?
Well, if I could just go back one step.
Sure.
You know, one of the issues with the one way to view this is, if you had a loved one who's going to go to prison, what you might want to do is shop all around America and do almost like you do with TripAdvisor or something for hotels. You'd want information about what is the experience, what is the quality of service at a given facility. And we don't really have that with public facilities, much less private. So even among public facilities, you have a wide range of quality. Mm-hmm. Some that may be very good and some that may be terrible, but we don't really know which ones are which. We don't systematically collect that information on a regular basis. And we don't do that even more so for private facilities. So, you know, in part, there's a lot we don't know about the amount and quality of services within the public prison sector, much less private. So even if you get rid of private prisons, you're still left with a problem, which is you don't really know what the quality is that is there. And that does create, you know, I think, fodder for people who are for private prisons, because there's clearly private prisons that are run really well, and then there's going to be ones that are terrible. So you're kind of, the larger issue, I think, partly in these public-private debates is a lack of really good, credible information about what we're getting with public or private facilities.
So what should we do?
Collect a lot better information, and it's totally doable. Gerald ran a great research unit, but we don't fund research remotely appropriately to the level of need. We can build a prison for, you know, $100 million and operate it at $20, $30 million a year annually, and yet we do almost no research that involves surveying inmates or officers on a regular basis. And, you know, the last decade's amazing with, you know, with technological advances, it's so much more possible to collect data directly from officers, directly from inmates. So we should collect better information from inmates about their experiences and the experiences that officers report as well.
Gerald Gaze, this ruling or this decision by the DOJ is affecting the Bureau of Prisoners only, inmates. It does not affect folks that are under marshals, which would be like the Central Texas Detention Center downtown San Antonio, or either of these refugee detention centers in South Texas. Do you think that they're going to start feeling a lot more pressure, though, to be included in these kinds of conversations?
You know, that remains to be seen. The marshals have quite a unique set of circumstances, and since they have to have a lot of facilities spread out all over the country, and most of the marshals' contracts are not with private facilities, but they're actually with state or locally owned jails.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not ICE or Homeland Security comes under pressure remains to be seen. That is a very large part of CCA and GO's market, and I think it's too early to tell whether or not this OIG report and the actions taken by the Deputy Attorney General will have any implications for Homeland Security.
I'm interested in both your comments real quickly. We talked at the beginning about how the zeitgeist was ready for privatized prisons at that time. You know, this just 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Texas closed two of its for-profit prison centers, and that was at the behest of advocacy groups on both the right and the left. Are we at a moment right now where the trend line is going to start going pretty aggressively the other direction?
My point of view is that there's such pluralism in this that some states are actually increasing their level of privatization. Other states are declining. So I think it's like a lot of things in the United States, because there are 51 separate criminal justice systems. It's going to be on a kind of a state-by-state, jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction trend.
Dan, you've got 15 seconds.
Sure. I think it may go downhill, but the decline in prison populations hasn't been that dramatic in the last year or two. And so, you know, betting money would be that the privatization will remain on the radar screen for years to come.
I'm afraid that's all the time we've got, guys. Daniel Mears is a criminology professor at Florida State University. Gerald Gay is a consultant and spent 22 years at the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you.
When The Source returns, a Texas judge issued a sweeping injunction against the Obama administration and its transgender policy for students. We get reaction. That's after the NPR news break. I'm Paul Flav. We'll be right back.